Dr. Ford and Judge Kavanaugh have been through a terrible couple weeks. They and their families have received vile threats.
What I find most inexcusable is this rush to judgment, the unwillingness to take these kinds of allegations at face value and look at them for what they are.
I am here today not because I want to be. I am terrified. I am here because I believe it is my civic duty to tell you what happened to me while Brett Kavanaugh and I were in high school. The details about that night that bring me here today are the ones I will never forget.
My family and my name have been totally and permanently destroyed by vicious and false additional accusations. You sowed the wind. For decades to come, I fear that the whole country will reap the whirlwind.
With what degree of certainty do you believe Brett Kavanaugh assaulted you?
100%.
No doubt in your mind.
Zero. I'm 100% certain.
So you're saying there's never been a case where you drank so much that you didn't remember what happened the night before or part of what happened?
That's, you're asking about, yeah, blackout. I don't know. Have you?
Boy, y'all want power. God, I hope you never get it. I hope the American people can see through this sham.
Did you watch Dr. Ford's testimony?
I did not.
It is not my responsibility to determine whether Mr. Kavanaugh deserves to sit on the Supreme Court. My responsibility is to tell you the truth.
Call the roll.
Mr. Hatch.
Aye.
Mr. Graham.
Aye.
Mr. Cornyn.
As a point of personal privilege, I'm going to call on Senator Flake to speak. Normally we would start the vote right now, but as a point of personal privilege, I would call on Senator Flake.
I think it would be proper to delay the floor vote for up to but not more than 1 week in order to let the FBI continue to do an investigation limited in time and scope to the current allegations that are there. And limit in time to no more than 1 week.
I'm Amy Walter. This is The Takeaway. It was an extraordinary couple of days on Capitol Hill. If there was a word I'd use to describe it, it was raw. Raw anger, raw memories, raw sadness, and raw partisanship. A hearing that was supposed to help clear up questions about an allegation of sexual assault from 1982 became a political and cultural reckoning. The Me Too movement clashing up against a deeply polarized political environment. There are long-term and short-term questions and consequences of this reckoning that need to be assessed. Most immediately, of course, is the impact this hearing had on influencing the votes of the senators responsible for deciding if Brett Kavanaugh will serve on the highest court of the land. What we do know is this. The Senate Judiciary Committee voted along party lines 11-10 to send Kavanaugh's confirmation to the full Senate for a vote. What we don't know is when or how that vote will happen. Senator Jeff Flake, who had been quiet throughout the Thursday hearing, but put out a statement on Friday that he would support Kavanaugh. Then he stunned those in the committee room when he asked Republicans to delay the final vote for a week so the FBI could investigate claims made by Dr. Blasey Ford.
And I've spoken to a few other members who on my side of the aisle that may be supportive as well. But that's my position. I think that that we ought to do what we can to make sure that that we do all due diligence with a nomination this important.
For a conservative take on the Kavanaugh nomination process so far, we have Noah Rothman, associate editor for Commentary Magazine.
It is a culmination of ultimately what a lot of voters who held their nose and voted for Donald Trump expected out of this presidency. And it is not a Trumpian moment. This moment has almost so little to do with this president, I think probably the least to do with this president from a conservative perspective since he's been elected to the presidency. On the dais in the Judiciary Committee, the righteous outrage of Lindsey Graham made headlines, but Ben Sasse's did not. And it was just as equal and visceral and real. They really do genuinely believe that a grave injustice has been done to this judge, a judge who is a farm team guy from the Bush years. Any president with an R after his name is likely to have nominated him or someone very similar. And they don't feel like he's been subject to a fair process. What we're seeing on their part is sort of a rallying back to a status quo anti-Trump, a real reversion to the mean. And I wouldn't speculate on what kind of effect that could have politically or electorally, but it is certainly a shift that we've not seen for well over 2 years at this point. The fractures within the Republican Party are being mended before our eyes.
Noah, as I watched the hearing pre-Blasey Ford accusations becoming public, it seemed that for the first time in a long time, the pro-Trump and the never-Trump wing of the Republican Party were coming together in support, not just for Brett Kavanaugh as a judge and as a person, but also uniting against what they saw were Democratic obstruction and attacks that were simply partisan. Were you seeing the same thing?
Absolutely. And I would go a step further and feel like and say that they feel rather betrayed. They recognize the political trap that they're in. They recognize that there is no good out for them here, that whatever they vote for is ultimately going to rock the foundations of the republic. It's going to make this a more disunited country, because it's a zero-sum game. Somebody is going to lose here, and somebody will feel as though a grave injustice has been done, and there is no recourse to the legal system, that they are simply going to be excluded from the justice to which they are entitled as a right as an American citizen, and there is no way to heal that wound. And Republicans will have to pull that trigger, and they feel like they didn't have to do that. They didn't have to be put in that position, because this could have been adjudicated in a fairer setting behind closed doors. It could have been brought to lawmakers' attentions far earlier than it was. They really are aggrieved by how they feel like they've been treated by the Democratic minority here. And that is what I think is really fueling this tribal impulse to come together over their whatever their objections or favors towards Trump are.
Do you see that we're at a point of no return now with Congress and the way in which Congress works or doesn't work, that this idea of getting a bipartisan agreement on something like a Supreme Court nomination is just done. We've crossed the Rubicon.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether we crossed it before, but I do feel like we've crossed it. I don't feel as though there can be a grand bargain here. I don't feel like there can be an agreement on an FBI investigation and a timeline or a circumspect date at which point we maybe confirm the lame duck process or something that might avert a crisis. This is a zero-sum game. There will be winners, there will be losers. And whoever loses will perceive a grave injustice to have been done, not just to them, but to millions of Americans. Supporters of Dr. Blasey Ford will perceive that there can be no justice, no legal recourse for women who have experienced what she alleges. Supporters of Dr. Kavanaugh will similarly feel, if he loses the seat, that he has been railroaded, that his family has been ruined behind rumors. And by the way, that will create a precedent in which we will judge future nominees and anyone who is a political appointee, by the way, by how they behaved as children. And that is something that we will really sincerely regret. No matter what happens here, someone's going to feel as though grave injustice has been done, and I don't think we can mend that.
What does this battle over Kavanaugh do to Republicans, the perception of the Republican Party among women?
It doesn't do them any good. That's for sure. I think just about everything that occurred yesterday redounds poorly to Republicans. Whether that's fair or not, I frankly don't believe it is. But I also don't think that this is going to redound to the GOP's benefit. Women who are energized to vote will be more energized to vote, and they're going to break wildly for Democrats and Republicans who perhaps are more energized by this process. I don't suspect that energy will last. And unless you see a Republican break against him, then he's going to be confirmed. And if a Republican breaks against him, Republicans are going to be discouraged. So there's very little political effect here that's going to help the GOP.
And is this, do you think, something that's a short-term loss for Republicans among women? Or is there potential that this is a moment where we look back to and we say, this was the time where we saw women move decisively toward the Democratic Party?
In terms of the 2018 election, most certainly it's going to be a formative moment for women voters, especially young women voters. But I don't expect that we're going to see anything permanent here. There's nothing permanent in American politics.
Noah Rothman, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So what impact will the hearings and the ultimate vote on Judge Kavanaugh have on voter interest and intensity for the November elections? For that, I turn to Claire Malone, a senior political writer at 538.
We don't have polling yet on what Americans think of the hearing yesterday, but anecdotally, I think a lot of people did watch it. A lot of people said that they were undecided on how they felt about Kavanaugh. The plurality of people in America, something 40-something percent of people didn't really have a thought about how they felt around him. But we do know that this issue of Kavanaugh's seat on the court is perhaps becoming more of one for voters on either side of the aisle. So I do think this could be, especially given Dr. Blasey Ford's pretty compelling testimony, I think that will speak to a lot of Democrats, perhaps. And we already see a section of Democrats, college-educated white women who are being activated in sort of this, I guess, the new year of the woman. You know, on the other hand, a lot of those people who would be up in arms about what they saw yesterday from the Democratic side maybe would already be turning out to vote anyway. So it's really hard to tell right now in this morning after the testimony.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to get to, which is the question of intensity. Would the hearing and the ultimate vote on Kavanaugh be something that would energize Republicans, what they saw yesterday?
Yeah. I mean, we do know that, you know, from past experience that Republicans have done a better job of sort of, I guess, electorally weaponizing Supreme Court seats to really make people turn out. What I think might be more electorally important with the Kavanaugh hearings is how it affects independents' view of things, view of the Republicans. You've got a couple of close, let's look at the Senate map just for sake of ease. You know, you've got Beto O'Rourke and Ted Cruz in Texas who are really fighting for independence. And we saw a split in polls about how independent-leaning women and independent-leaning men felt about the Kavanaugh-Ford allegations and just the whole saga. Independent women were more likely to have a favorable view of Ford. Independent men were more likely to have a favorable view of Kavanaugh. And I think we're going to see in a lot of races like Florida and Texas, those kind of, you know, Joe Manchin in West Virginia, Donnelly in Indiana, you're going to see a lot of those independent voters, I think, maybe be the deciding margin. And so I'm kind of interested to see how they perceived the essentially high, you know, high profile he said, she said that took place yesterday in Washington.
Claire Malone is senior political writer at 538.
The Takeaway is supported by LegalZoom, helping Americans take control of their families and assets with last will and living trust estate plans. More information available at LegalZoom.com/takeaway.
Supreme Court justices are intended to be impartial, presiding over a judicial body that's above the partisan fray. And though that image has been eroded over the years, justices have worked hard to keep appearances in order to maintain the integrity of the highest court in the land. So did that effort get erased entirely on Thursday? Professor Barbara Perry is the Presidential Studies Director at University of Virginia's Miller Center. Professor Perry, thanks for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure.
Professor Perry, from your vantage point, watching the hearings the other day, is this something that's unique? Have we ever seen something like the hearings that we had on Thursday?
No, as is so much the case in the Trump era, it is unprecedented. If you mix together where we are now in the Trump era with social media and 24/7 coverage and certainly television on the scene, and the mixture of tribal politics and sexual situations, and it's just explosive. It's just that so-called perfect storm.
I want to play specifically something that Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican from South Carolina, said about the process itself.
I hope the American people can see through this sham. God, I hate to say it, because these have been my friends. But let me tell you, when it comes to this, you're looking for a fair process? You came to the wrong town at the wrong time, my friend.
Have we reached a new tipping point in the polarization of the Senate? And if so, can we ever go back?
I think the answer to the first is yes, we've reached a new tipping point. And the answer to the second question is I don't see us going back from this. We've crossed the Rubicon, I think, sad to say. Particularly because it was Lindsey Graham, I thought of his good, dear, and late friend, John McCain. Because, as we know, John McCain could be irascible and could get angry, but he did try to do that crossing of the aisle. And the kinds of language that Senator Graham was using yesterday, how can you go back from that? There are relationships that can never be repaired. It's like a terrible divorce among these senators and certainly between the two parties.
So is that where we're headed to in terms of this process? Do you think we're going to a point where every nomination is going to feel like a war?
There is one bit of good news, I think, on that, as I made reference to swing seats. And I used to refer to this as the swing seat politics. And that swing seat politics has always been more vehement. If you think back to the Robert Bork hearings and the fact that he went down to defeat in a newly Democratic, at that time, new majority of the Democrats in 1987. And they took that opportunity to put him down to defeat because he was so conservative, had such a long track record, did not present himself well in front of the committee. And so down to defeat he went. He was not confirmed. That was for the swing seat that had been held by Justice Lewis Powell, who had retired. Also, think back to when Justice O'Connor left. Alito made it through, but Ted Kennedy tried to mount a filibuster. It wasn't successful, but that was another turning point. And now for the swing seat of Justice Kennedy, it was predictable. Maybe not the level of vehemence, maybe not the exact circumstances of this sexual assault charge against the nominee. But I think the good news, if there is a little bright ray of hope shining through this darkness, it is that perhaps when it is not a swing seat at issue, the politics will not be as strained and difficult and nasty.
That's nice of you to believe that. We all, I guess, we all need to believe that. Well, let's
Santa Claus for a really long time.
let's rewind for a minute and take sort of a 30,000-foot look on public perceptions of the Supreme Court. What do Americans think of when they think of the Supreme Court, especially how they think of it vis-a-vis the other branches of government?
This is one of my favorite topics as both a scholar of the Supreme Court and the presidency and a bit of the Congress as well, is that I've traced this over the last quarter century. And the good news for the court is that it has almost always been at the top. And you might say, well, that's a low bar to meet, because look at where Congress typically falls in approval rating, sometimes in the single digits, sometimes at best in the teens. But the court has been at an average of over 50% of approval rating. So most recently, the Supreme Court in a Gallup poll came out at 53%, just after Justice Kennedy retired and the naming of Brett Kavanaugh to fill the seat. It was up to 53%. In fact, it had tracked upward over the last 9 years or so. And part of this is because the court has always been viewed by the American people as typically being above the muck and mire of daily politics.
And do you think what happened this week will have an impact on public opinion polling? Do you think it will actually fundamentally change the way that people see the court?
I think your key word there is fundamentally. I'm not sure that one day and one hearing can destroy the history of this great institution, but it could chip away, certainly, at how people view the court. And for those Americans in the tribe, and we have to call it tribal now, who yesterday did not believe Judge Kavanaugh and believe that if confirmed that he will be a sexual assault perpetrator on the Supreme Court, they will have to lose faith in that institution, I am sorry to say.
How do you think the other justices, the ones who are sitting right now on the Supreme Court, viewed this?
They must be shuddering. I can't think that they could see this in any other way. Now, having said that, Justice Thomas has stated that when he arrived at the court after his very controversial hearing, that he was told just leave that behind. You are welcome here. We're putting it behind. We're moving on. And that is the good thing about the court. But one does have to question, for example, how will Justice Ginsburg view this person? She is known as a pioneer of feminism, a pioneer of gender equality. We should also state that she was best friends with Nino Scalia on the opposite side of the spectrum. But we also know that they respected each other, and they respected each other's politics and intellect.
Barbara, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with me today.
It is my honor to speak with you on this very important subject.
Professor Barbara Perry is Presidential Studies Director at University of Virginia's Miller Center.
When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
This week, world leaders gathered in New York for the 73rd session of the United Nations General Assembly. President Trump reiterated his commitment to an America First agenda, and world leaders began moving on without the United States. French President Emmanuel Macron proposed countries refuse to sign trade deals with those who do not comply with the Paris Climate Treaty. Germany, France, Britain, Russia, China, and Iran recommitted to the Iran nuclear deal, moving ahead without the U.S.
People are scared of the globalization monster as they see it. And that's partly because the worst instincts of it haven't been tamed properly.
To help us assess the role of the United States in the global community, I sat down this week with former Secretary of State John Kerry, who spoke about the fear of globalism and the geopolitical consequences of giving into that fear.
The movement of factories or goods because of trade, or the wages that don't seem to go up sufficiently. And so there's a lot of anxiety in our country, understandable and real, as a result of what has happened to the relationships around the planet. But we're not responding properly to that, I believe. I think we did under President Obama. I think now we're roiling the waters of our alliances in very dangerous ways. We are abdicating certain choices and responsibilities to other countries. And now we see China and Russia actively working to dismantle the narrative that sustained our progress during the last century and the early part of the 21st, which is American leadership and the liberal order of the West. And now you hear President Xi and you hear President Putin attacking that and providing an alternative narrative, which is this is going to be the China century and so forth. We have to push back against that by showing our values, by living our values.
But do you see this as a continuing battle long after Trump is no longer president, that the country is still, whoever the next president is,
always there will be that struggle.
It's always going to be that struggle, right?
Yes, there will be some of that struggle. But the issue is, do you have a leader who is articulating the reasons specifically for why this is good, a certain track is good for the United States? Let me be explicit. The United States of America can't just trade with itself. 95% of the world's customers live in other countries. And if you're going to grow your economy, you're not going to grow it by shutting down and turning inwards. You have to engage in relationships. But the trade relationships have to change from what they were. The president is actually correct. And we also were correct, because we all pointed out that China is not allowing adequate access to the market. China is applying rules that are unfair and demanding technology transfer, et cetera, et cetera. There are a lot of different things to be arguing about. The question is, how do you go at it? The way the president's going at it, I think it's going to compound matters, make them worse, and in the end will most likely cost jobs and raise prices for average Americans. I think there's a better way to go at it. But leaving that aside, we're going to have to continue to articulate to our fellow citizens why it makes a difference. I'll give you an example. I mean, if we're going to fight terrorism and we're going to minimize the need to deploy American troops to other countries to fight it, it would help if those countries were able to send some of their kids to school or build some infrastructure or do things. China is spending $1 trillion a year now, touching 70 different countries heading towards Europe and East Asia, not to mention what they're doing in South Central Asia or Africa or other places, in order to develop infrastructure, in order to build relationships. We're not. We're just not doing that. And so I think we have a waning leverage for the interests of our country in order to have outcomes that we want. And I think that's dangerous for us.
What's a part of the world that you think is a place we're not spending enough time looking at, either because of its opportunity or because of its potential danger as we look down the road?
There are a number of them. I mean, frankly, globally, we have retreated and withdrawn on a critical issue, which is called climate change. And the United States under President Obama, we led the effort to get there, to bring China to the table, to get the Paris Agreement passed. And now, tragically, we've seen a president literally walk away from it, pull out of it, and not offer American leadership. In addition, on trade, there are legitimate things to perhaps tweak in the TPP and fix if you don't like them. But to walk away without getting any of that done is to have pulled our hard-fought-for influence out of the region and out of the 12 countries, us included, that were going to be part of that agreement. The other 11 have now gone forward with the agreement, but writing out the things that were beneficial to the United States. So we lose, and we've lost the influence there. I mean, there are other places, similarly, in Europe, we just don't have the relationships that we did in order to fix certain things that we need to fix. So I think I worry very, very much about the Horn of Africa, North Africa, development. I worry about corruption on a global basis. I worry about the South Central Asia, where there are some real challenges in terms of extremism and what may happen if we don't deal with that. You know, there are 1.8 billion children who are 15 years old or younger in the world. Perhaps 300, 350 million of them are not going to go to school. They're just not going to go to school anywhere. And from what I heard from fellow foreign ministers and others in the regions, the extremists are grabbing their kids at age 12, 13, 14. They pay them a stipend for a while, and then they proselytize to them, and then those guys become the recruiters. They don't have to be paid anymore. And this foreign minister said to me, you know, these guys have a 35-year plan, and we don't even have a 5-year plan. I think there's no over there anymore in the world. We're all connected. Even people in poverty have smartphones. They see what other people have. They're able to communicate. And if we don't have the right value system and the right levels of education in this increasingly technological world, we're asking for trouble in the long run. And that is the security of the United States of America, put bluntly. No other way to say it.
Among the many topics we addressed, the secretary told me he stopped paying attention to every tweet coming from the president.
I forget about the daily tweets. It's a waste of time. Focus on the things that make a difference to the quality of life of our fellow Americans and start to make a set of better choices about those things.
But recently, Secretary Kerry found himself in a Twitter skirmish with the administration. According to critics, Kerry overstepped boundaries when he met with Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif well after he left office. Here's UN Ambassador Nikki Haley on Fox and Friends.
What Secretary Kerry did was not only disrespectful, it was hurtful to America. When we are sitting there trying to get Iran to come to the table in a way that they understand the ballistic missile testing has to stop, the support of terrorism has to stop, they have to quit selling arms to the Houthis. When all those things, to have another American go in and say, don't worry about it, that absolutely is anti-American, and it was hurtful to the American people.
So why did he take to Twitter to reply to his critics? I do wonder your decision to go to Twitter to respond, how you made that, and whether you
Well,
think,
I just thought I just thought it was so absurd, but so insidious in a sense. I mean, alleging that I was doing something I wasn't doing. And I learned in 2004 with the Swift Boat stuff, don't let anything like that sit there and stand there. The fact is that I have not met with the Iranians from the moment the president made the decision to get out of the deal. From the moment they laid down a policy, I have not met with them. So that was just a complete misstatement, number two. I only met in the context of a global conference. I was at the Munich Security Conference. I was at the UN General Assembly when other senators, by the way, I wasn't a senator at the time, I'm a former senator, but active senators met with them. Other people met with them. The Council for Foreign Relations in New York met with them. The New York Times board met with them, et cetera. And, you know, Henry Kissinger, of course, has made, what, 40 years now. He's been traveling to China, traveling to Russia, meeting with people. And I discussed in full with Secretary Pompeo before they made the decision. I gave him my point of view. It's very nice. He listened to me at length. We had a long discussion about it. He gave me a lot of time. And then they made their decision. And I haven't met with anybody since that decision was made.
The back and forth, though, on Twitter, you also got a couple of sort of Trumpian moments in there about maybe you should be paying more attention to Mueller than me and dig on Omarosa. Do you feel like you have to respond to Trump in the way that he uses Twitter, the way he acts toward people?
I said what I thought ought to be said,
yeah.
Period. I mean, I said what I thought ought to be said, and enough said. I think that, I don't think anybody's well served by the process, but I mean, obviously that's the way he's approached his presidency from the day he started running, and it hasn't changed, and his own staff appear to have given up on trying to control it.
Twitter fights aside, this is a pivotal moment in U.S.-Iranian relations. This week at the U.N., President Trump strongly condemned Iran.
The Iranian regime exports violence, terror, and turmoil. It illicitly procures sensitive items to advance its ballistic missile program and proliferates these missiles all across the Middle East.
Meanwhile, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani criticized the U.S. strategy and called for a return to negotiations.
The United States' understanding of international relations is authoritarian. In its estimation, might makes right.
Rouhani also criticized the economic sanctions imposed by the U.S., calling them a form of economic terrorism. Meanwhile, several European nations and other members of the Iran nuclear deal announced this week a mechanism to continue to do business with the country and bypass U.S. sanctions. Again, more isolation for the United States. I asked Secretary Kerry if this is an inflection point in our relationship, not just with Iran, but with our allies.
I think Iran is considerably more complicated than the administration has allowed for, and the president understands. All of us, our prior administrations, Democrats, Republicans, we all object to Iran's intervention in other countries. We object to their missile program. We did object when I was negotiating the agreement, and we didn't change the relationship on that. We kept missile sanctions in place in that agreement. We kept sanctions in place on human rights. We kept sanctions in place on the transfer of weapons to Yemen and elsewhere, and we raised those sanctions. So nobody takes a second seat to objections to Iran's foreign policy choices. Support for Hezbollah, we objected. We labeled the Hezbollah a terrorist organization. I mean, so we've been very clear about those things. And nobody should play a game saying, well, you don't care about those things, you're not. The issue is, how do you change those things? And in the Obama administration, the president and all of us agreed on a fundamental decision. You're better off dealing with missiles and dealing with support for terrorism and dealing with these things if they don't have a nuclear weapon than if they do, or if they're not moving towards a nuclear weapon than if they are. And so we specifically said, let's get the nuclear weapon off the table while we continue to press these other issues. And what President Trump has done is just pulled out of the agreement, basically making America the country that has broken the agreement. and alienating Russia, China, France, Germany, Britain, all of whom helped get the agreement and all of whom are trying to keep the agreement. So if there were to be some flare-up as a result of this effort now, those countries are not going to rush into the UN Security Council with us. They're going to say, you broke it. You know, you fix it. It's made it exceedingly difficult for any Iranian leader politically to just sit down with them and say, oh, okay, this is good. We'll do everything you told us to do. No leader can survive. So from a negotiating point of view, I think you would have been far better off, and I said this to administration folks who would listen, by staying in the agreement and making the ultimatums to Iran with the other countries at your side, all of you pushing for the change of behavior. And I think that the situation's actually been made more dangerous, not less, as a result of the choice the president made.
And do you think that this choice that the president made was aimed at President Obama himself or the policy?
I don't know. I can't get into the psychobabble of it all. I just don't know. All I know is a decision was made, which I think is not in the best interests of getting done what we need to get done, and has made the world slightly more turbulent as a result.
John Kerry was Secretary of State under the Obama administration. His new memoir is called Every Day is Extra. And that's our show for today. We wanted to leave the last word to you and your reactions to the Kavanaugh confirmation process.
This is Maggie. I'm calling from Fort Lauderdale. Why is this allowed to stand? I don't understand. There are double standards. He's too emotional. Hello. Way too emotional. If a woman had acted the way he did, crying, yelling, interrupting the senators, he was completely over the line. A woman in his position would have immediately been disqualified.
My name is Abraham from Brooklyn. Christine Blasey Ford was very credible, and it is apparent that something terrible happened to her. And at the same time, Judge Kavanaugh was extremely credible, and it was clear that he was reacting as an innocent man who's been smeared of a terrible thing, and he reacted appropriately as a wounded man. And I think the nonpartisan way to look at this is they can both be right.
What are your thoughts on the nomination process? Where do you stand? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Amy Walter, and this is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.